Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Chad Spencer Keller, author of Beyond Avery Road, Beauting and the Beast, joins us tonight for part two of his interview alongside Wisconsin political insider using the pseudonym Juan Tescrew. Tonight's discussion will detail the recent denial of Stephen Avery's new trial in Manitowoc County as they speak about what happens next from here with defense attorney Kathleen Zellner. Going forward, Juan Tescrew and Keller will deliver evidence as to the importance of why all eyes need to be diverted to the politics stemming from Avery's 2003 exoneration and what was happening in Madison at the state capitol during Teresa Halbach's alleged death in 2005. Keller states the case is political. The deck was stacked. It basically became a bipartisan effort by both parties that leaves Stephen Avery in the situation he is in. Juan Tescrew will be vouching for the severe conflict of interest that Keller presents in his book and hopes the two can shed light that Stephen Avery never had a chance to begin with. It takes us back to the $36 million question, was Stephen Avery framed? Keller also exposes how the electronic monitoring of juveniles law could have protected Brendan Dassey and released him the very same month that he was arrested in, for his alleged confession on March 1st, 2006. Joining us right now are my very special guests, Chad Spencer Keller and Juan Tescrew. Can their evidence expose a factual miscarriage of justice inside of the Wisconsin Department of Justice and free Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey? The book that we're featuring tonight is Beyond Avery Road, and the story is Stephen Avery, Retrial Denied. With my special guests, journalist and author Chad Keller and political insider Juan Tescrew. Welcome, gentlemen, to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. Chad Keller and Juan Tescrew.
Thanks for having us on, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. In light of the development just yesterday, 24 hours, incredible timing for this program, tell us briefly, gentlemen, with you first, Juan, what is your reaction to the decision? Just tell us, for those people that haven't been under a rock for a while, haven't heard this decision, tell us briefly what the decision is and what is your reaction?
Well, the decision is made by a judge named Angela Sutkowitz, I believe her name is, who is from Sheboygan County, which is the county along the lake south of Manitowoc. And apparently she's also had some other dealings with Stephen Avery, or has said some things. So in theory, she probably should have recused herself from the case, but didn't. But essentially what she did was bar his attorney, Kathleen Zellner's motion, saying that the evidence isn't justified to grant a new trial. I read her decision, and honestly, you could pull quite a few holes in and out of itself. A couple of things were decisions that, okay, yeah, I can see where you'd make the argument, but nothing, as far as I'm concerned, to where if I was a jury and that was her argument, she wouldn't win the argument, in my opinion. But essentially, it is lower court ruling. Zellner's correct in her tweet to say there are higher courts. It's not the end of the world. Fortunately for Steve, it's just like anything. You know, if you get hit in the face, you know, unless it's by Scarlett Johansson or something, it's probably going to be pretty unpleasant. And Chad can tell you that Steven's pretty bummed out about it. But it's not the final. It's not the end of the road. There are other appeals, and she said in some of her tweets that she does have new evidence, new witnesses. And because the case was basically what the judge said was that you can't use the stuff that was found as evidence before, it's not that much of a detriment necessarily, because Zellner had presented the motion based on new evidence. So I don't know how far that goes to where they can attach the new evidence to the old evidence, but all in all, in the big picture, I don't believe this is going to hinder Stephen Avery's chances of being freed, and especially with the information that Chad's book has brought forth, you add that to the stew, and you're going to have a pretty yummy stew that hopefully puts the correct people behind bars, if that answers your question.
It does. Chad, I want to ask you first, based on everything that you've written about, were you surprised at the decision? And then what parts of this judge's decision, her argument against this and for this denial, what parts were you surprised with? Were you surprised at this decision? Tell us what surprised you and didn't surprise you with this decision yesterday.
Well, Dan, it's Manitowoc County, so nothing really surprises me at the county level. What is surprising is that the judge was making small little arguments and just trying to beat it to death and just nitpicking at any little thing to keep Stephen from getting a retrial there in Manitowoc County. But the Zellner is going to try to file a new brief. She stated, I think, before Thanksgiving, and it's going to go to the Wisconsin Court of Appellate, which will be a better court for Stephen to have a retrial in. I think the playing field will be better leveled for him. But, I mean, there's some things that need to go on before this trial takes place. And one of those things is getting certain people attached to the new appeal off of it.
And who are some of those people that need to be off of this appeal, as you say?
Right now, the Assistant Attorney General, Thomas J. Fallon, is handling the appeal for Stephen Avery and then Norman Gann. And these people were directly related to an affiliation with Peg Lautenschlager's political agenda at the time of this 2005 incident. And they need to be recused from this immediately.
But is there anyone other than you officially calling for this and demanding this? And if there is, how effective is that demand? How effective do you think that demand will be?
I think a lot of Avery supporters want these people recused, but a lot of them and a lot of people are still blind about Thomas J. Fallon being third in command of the entire state, and they see Ken Kratz as like the so-called villain and making a murderer the prosecutor. But Kratz was a fall guy. Kratz is absolutely a nobody in this case. The person with all the power who stepped onto the scene whenever Brendan Dassey was coerced and become a part of the prosecution is Fallon. Fallon was third in command of the state, and he's still in third in command of the entire state. And that's the real state power that people have got to get their mind grasped around, to understand that he had the power to throw the match in the original trial.
Let's talk to Juan and ask. I want to ask the question about Brendan Dassey. Not everybody's up to completely on speed on what has happened. People have seen Making of a Murderer, that first season. Surely people have heard that the confession has been deemed to be coerced, and we've heard about his mental capabilities or disabilities. Let's talk about what's happened in the summer and the fall regarding Brendan Dassey. Juan Tescrew.
Well, essentially, last summer when Judge Duffin basically granted that writ of habeas corpus to Brendan Dassey, Brad Schimmel decided to appeal that within the 90 days. And this is kind of where I'm questioning Brad Schimmel, because I do know that Brad Schimmel is a member of the Republican Party. And in the years prior, leading up to the 2016 election and even 2014 election, there were numerous instances and cases where the opposing party was trying to railroad his Republican Party. And to date, even though there were many infractions that realistically should have been looked at quite soon, he hasn't even looked at those particular cases that dealt with blows to his party. But he can take the time, you know, to take some poor 16-year-old kid and, you know, appeal within 90 days, which is only 3 months, a confession where anybody who looks at that tape, Ray Charles could look at the tape and say, hey, at worst, you could say, you know, the kid was probably coerced. I mean, anybody with eyes is going to say, yeah, it's pretty blatant. But they took the time to actually appeal that. They lost in the Seventh Circuit by 2-1. They took the time to en banc that, and they just recently held a hearing where Laura Nyrider, or Nyrider, I don't know how to pronounce her name, the young lady for the Innocence Project from that Dassey was working with, they gave their respective speeches, so to speak. And you could tell that there were some judges who were quite favorable towards Dassey and others weren't. And there are also, I believe, Luke Berg had a huge conflict of interest with Judge Sykes, yet these things go through all the time. So there's some instances within those instances that need to be addressed and looked at. But essentially, that's what we're waiting on, is for this panel to make their next decision so that we can go forth to see whether or not Mr. Dassey reigns victorious. Because if he reigns victorious, what does that mean for Stephen Avery? Is that a complete game changer? Are they going to say kind of what they did yesterday and say, well, too bad, that somehow doesn't count? So this is going to be a really interesting turn of events. Quite honestly, if it wasn't so drawn out, it would make Game of Thrones and House of Cards and Orange is the New Blood, nobody be watching those shows, because they want to see what these real life twists and turns have in the Wisconsin political system that has a little bit of a tinge of corruption. Again, if that answers your question.
Has there been any comment from the producers of Making a Murderer to this decision, but also to the assertions in this book? Chad?
As far as the creators are concerned, a lot of them was helped out by Jerome Buten, the defense counsel for Stephen Avery, while making this documentary, and a lot of them are still it's a hurdle to say if Buten was involved with the state or not. I have numerous facts that puts him in Lautenschlager's pocket, actually. But as far as the creators, I mean, Buten jump-started the creators' careers, and they're all for him. So I mean, it's hard to get any response back from them just because of that aspect.
You assert in this book, and we didn't get to it last time, so I'm going to ask you this because it is fascinating how far you go into this, inference after inference, fact, evidence that you provide, incredibly compelling argument in this book in so many directions. We talked about the Attorney General and her complicity in this and her connections. If you think there's corrupt police, well, then who was in control of the corrupt police? You pose that question. But you talk about Teresa Halbach's last day and her connection, Peg Lautenschlager, Laudingslager to that particular day and to Teresa Halbach. Chad, tell us about that.
Teresa Halbach had visited Stephen P. Smith on the morning that she allegedly died. That was her first visit to take photos for Auto Trader magazine. And what's interesting about this case, Stephen P. Smith lives in the same area as Peg Lautenschlager, which is in Fond du Lac area. And her campaign manager for her actual attorney general run whenever she campaigned, Todd M. Smith, is Stephen P. Smith's blood relative. So on the day that Teresa is last seen alive by her first photographer session that she does, she's actually visiting a blood relative of her campaign manager. And now what is so conflicting about this is Peg Lautenschlager has declined to speak for 12 years now on anything to do with the Halbach case. She'll speak that Gregory Allen in the 1985 Penny Bernstein case, that there wasn't enough witness identification to prove Gregory Allen as the suspect of Penny Bernstein and not Stephen Avery. So she kind of protects Manitowoc County there, but she should speak up for her whereabouts on where she was the day that Teresa Halbach would allegedly die, because Teresa was in her own backyard, so to speak.
Now, with that, you would think that you are not, certainly not hiding any of these facts, and you've been very vocal in promoting yourself and the allegations and assertions and the claims that you make in this book. What is the reaction from the Department of Justice to some of the things you have said? And if there is no reaction, what do you conclude from that?
Well, there has been an actual reaction. Ken Kratz, we exchanged emails, and he told me that he was going to forward my information to Thomas J. Fallon and would be that I'd probably be in touch with if I released my book for criminal defamation. And we're talking like there's millions of supporters here, and this is the state capital of Wisconsin, where Thomas J. Fallon's desk is, and he's going to forward information about my book straight to the Assistant Attorney General of Wisconsin. I mean, that shows that the information in my book is a threat to them, you know? I mean, I haven't heard anything else from Kratz, but I'm wide open for whatever they want to confront me with in it, because I would like to actually challenge them with a deposition in it, but they won't do that at this point, because if they start releasing information about Lautenschlager and Fallon's emails with Lautenschlager's, Buden's emails with Lautenschlager, Kratz's, Fassbender's, all these key people involved in these cases, this is going to blow this thing wide open. So they're actually just writing it off right now, because if they dive into it, then they're opening up a can of worms. And I mean, it's going to be very bad for the state. And I'm just trying to get anybody in the media, anybody to get Lautenschlager to answer the questions in this book.
Absolutely. Juan, you talked about that this is not the end for Stephen Avery, and that there is some optimism, it sounds like, from you, for a federal appeal, if I'm not correct. So tell us what you think those grounds are federally that they have this leg to stand on, what they will base or likely will, or what you think is the strongest grounds that they have for this federal appeal.
Well, the strongest grounds, in my opinion, that they have is in a, I think it's 200, what is it, 73 pages in a book called Beyond Avery Road, because it exposes things that has nothing to do with what's already been churned out in the past or in the present. And it can make connections to where it in itself will allow anyone who reads it to say, well, there's enough reasonable doubt to say that even if it's not circular, isn't all these people were tied in, which I'm sure we'll get to before the end of the program. But even one or two, as long as there's one or two, that's all you need. Matter of fact, that's what happened in the OJ case. Of course, it's a little bit different. But the federal part of the appeal, which is the last one, which is what Brandon is the habeas corpus writ, and that's usually the hardest, believe it or not. Matter of fact, they're not granted very often, from my understanding. But more than likely, what's going to happen is the next appeals court will be the kicker slash winner. Because then after that is the Wisconsin Supreme Court. My guess is if somehow, for whatever reason, our information doesn't make it out there, which I can't foresee that happening because, quite frankly, we've got the nuts hand. But that will be where the real decision will be made when it comes to Stephen Avery, just on what Zellner is presenting in her motions. But again, with Brendan, if Stephen Avery was convicted on what Brendan's testimony was, and Brendan's testimony gets thrown out, well, that changes the game altogether. So when I said before that I don't think it's the be all end all for Stephen Avery, there's a lot more in the arsenal. But as far as I'm concerned, the best weapon in that arsenal is exactly the stuff we're talking about, and it's exactly the stuff that's in Chad's book, Beyond Avery Road. Again, because regardless of what evidence they try to suppress, regardless of who said what, if you've got documentation and if you've got trails that tie everybody together that say that this is a stacked deck, none of that other stuff matters. I mean, honestly, in that scenario, Stephen could have actually done it and still walk free because of the connections and the circular roundabout way that everybody behind the scenes worked together on this to put Stephen in the situation he's in. So,
Chad, you talked about Zellner, the defense attorney Zellner's approach with this, and we haven't talked about that, and that is that she has another suspect. She names another person of interest. Tell us who that other person, that other suspect is, and was this, in hindsight, a good strategy? Is this the way to go? Is it the way she must go? What do you think, Chad?
As far as her suspect, Teresa Halbach's ex-boyfriend, Ryan Hillegass, he was never protected under the Denny law, that was filed in motion during the pretrial, and it's a constitutional loophole where she can backdoor the appeals courts by saying, "Hey, we have a suspect here," and this correlates. Her theory is that Ryan Hillegass is responsible for bludgeoning Teresa Halbach to death. Now, why I think she's going with that motive, if you take Brendan Dassey and he gets his habeas approved and he wins his case, then the state no longer has a smoking bullet because Norman Gann, one of the people I've been fighting to get removed, he in the original trial said, we omitted the contaminated bullet fragment and we deviated from protocol to make sense. And that was because of Brendan Dassey's confession. Now, if the confession gets turned over, then the state no longer has a smoking gun because Brendan Dassey's confession is no good and it no longer puts the two in the garage with shooting Teresa in the head as the state alleged in the first trial. So then Zellner can provide the information that for reasonable doubt, and she doesn't have to prove that this ex-boyfriend's the killer. All she has to do is provide reasonable doubt that Teresa was bludgeoned to death. And when you no longer have a smoking gun because the state bullet isn't corroborated by Brendan's testimony anymore, then the state can't use that piece of evidence. So that establishes reasonable doubt that Teresa could have been bludgeoned to death by Ryan Hillgas. It's a very good move on her behalf because, I mean, Fallon and the prosecution team, they kind of sewed this thing up and exhausted every appeal they could think of during the original trial. And there's just one loophole that they didn't think about, and that was that Denny didn't protect the ex-boyfriend. So Zellner is using that angle here, which is an actual – it's a brilliant angle to go through. Me personally, I've done a lot of research on Ryan. I mean, as far as him being the killer, if he worked with the police in this, he could be the killer. But we'll have to leave that for Zellner and her experts to establish that.
Now, you talked about if Brandon Dassey, his confession is thrown out. But if he talks, if it, there is another retrial, we'll say. So we're talking about what happens if you're talking about the state and the power of the state so far to transform this innocent person into a guilty person and do all this stuff, all this incredible behind the scenes stuff. Why would it not be continuing? So it sounds like you're optimistic that there could be some things, but isn't Brendan Dassey, isn't he vulnerable to being able to be retried again? And if the state already has this intention to do what they've done so far, according to you, Chad and Juan, then why not continue with that?
Well, as far as Dassey being retried anywhere, that's up for the higher courts to determine. I mean, I can't make that determination. That'll be for the courts. As far as the Attorney General and Assistant Attorney General Fallon and Schimmel, they both share an office, and Fallon worked with Peg, and Fallon, I believe, is duping Schimmel to process everything politically and in the judicial system to not let any of these people get retried. Because if any of this evidence comes to light, I mean, it's a rug sweep. They've been trying to sweep it and sweep it and sweep it. I mean, and this hasn't just gone on through Schimmel's current attorney general. This went on with the Attorney General Van Hollen, who preceded Lautenschlager and or succeeded Lautenschlager, and then Schimmel succeeded him. This is Avery's third appeal here, and they don't want any of this going to court. I mean, these people were given awards at the end of this trial. The person who allegedly coerced Brendan Dassey was given an award. Fassbender, Norman Gann is now considered the pioneer of DNA in Wisconsin for submitting a contaminated bullet fragment. I mean, you know, this is absurd that all these people get these awards, and as far as any retrials or anything, if they ever happen, the information of everything that circulates in my book, there's so many facts that just show that everyone was connected in a bipartisan effort to railroad Stephen. I mean, it just blows your mind when you get to see how many people were working together on this that had a political agenda. And to me, this entire thing's a political conviction. And that's why Attorney General Schimmel and Assistant Attorney General Fallon will not allow any of this to go to a new trial, because they want to prevent that.
I mean, in fact, this entire case, and this is my opinion, this entire case is about that. Chad just mentioned how Ken Kratz was saying that he's going to pass this on to Fallon, and yet nothing's happened. Well, why? Well, because if he decides to open a court case in defamation, that means it opens up everything to be scrutinized. That's the one thing they don't want. And if you think about what happened way back when right before this happened, Everybody except for two people were deposed. The Dennis Vogel, who was the DA, and Sheriff Tom Kasurek. Okay, and nobody, and this is where I really start to question the motive, because a lot of, you'd mentioned in your intro, it's a $36 million question. Well, me knowing about the way politics runs, Wisconsin's got pretty much a balanced budget, but the Department of Transportation was the reason, the main reason that Wisconsin's budget, which is supposed to be passed in June, didn't get passed until just recently, a couple weeks ago. And the Department of Transportation has got a budget shortfall of $939 million. That's about almost $1 billion. $36 million is a sneeze to bureaucrats. So when people say, okay, it was about the money, sure, perhaps. But the one thing that absolutely stopped when Stephen Avery got arrested, okay, and Chad could tell you all about that, on how the gun charge turned into something else because of where the evidence was stored in Manitowoc. But the one thing that stopped was that investigation. And if anybody ever watches Better Call Saul, the ex-Philly cop, Mike Ehrmantraut, says, you know what a cop fears most? It's not getting shot, it's not getting killed in the line of duty. It's prison. All right? You threaten a cop with that, you make him dangerous. When that investigation stopped, everything that we might have found out didn't see the light of day, and to this day hasn't seen the light of day. So that's why Schimmel and everybody doesn't want this out. That's why Fallon doesn't want this out. That's why anybody, you know, Fallon with the defamation case, nobody wants to open this can of worms. They all want it to just go away. So it screams the question, what is it? And then you add that with everything you find in Chad's book on how Buting is tied to Lautenschlager, and everybody's tied to everybody else. You have to really wonder, what is it? What is it that hasn't been found? What is it that hasn't been investigated? And what is it that they are hiding so bad that they are willing to keep an innocent, you know, mentally challenged boy who's never even voted once in his life, probably never driven a car, to keep that man in jail until he's 50 years old? To hide what? So the chances of this stuff being seeing the light of day on an accord other than people getting behind us and you know, signing that petition to get these guys removed, you know, that's going to be the real kicker to this.
Chad, you make assertions in here. We talked about Hallback and the inference that she was connected with people that were handling her. And you make inferences in the book, and I'll just say that some of the things that you say about Peg Lautenschlager being involved with this and the state of Teresa Hallback, you have some theories, and you have some, you put out the idea that Teresa Hallback may have had some other reason to die that day when we talked about the alleged murder we talk about in the introduction. So, Chad, let's just have it. What are you trying to say? What do you say regarding Teresa Hallback, her death? What do you have to say?
Well, it goes back to when Teresa leaves Fond du Lac that morning. The only person that really knows what time she's going to even arrive into Manitowoc, okay, Stephen knows when she's going to get – Stephen knows when she's there, but he doesn't know what time he's coming. But the person who can best give an estimate time for her arrival is the person who sees her after that first appointment, which is Stephen P. Schmitz. So if she's leaving his property and his blood relative is Todd M. Schmitz's – is Todd M. Schmitz, and that's Lautenschlager's campaign manager for her attorney general run, and he's a member of the Fond du Lac board, and I mean it's a really tight knit political group right there. It just goes to show that Lautenschlager's own political agenda and the people involved in it knew exactly when she left Fond du Lac, and In the book, I give several incidents to inferences to Teresa Hallback being terminally ill, and I think this process was kind of sped up. I left a lot of people out of it personally for civil litigations, and kind of introduced the terminal illness so no one could really charge me with any litigation stuff about just saying, hey, you're saying that I killed her and I'm going to sue you. The terminal illness references that I make in the book, I mean, there's some solid facts there, but I still think that whatever happened was complications between Fond du Lac and Manitowoc after she left Stephen Avery's house, and then it was just picked up on. You know, there's a report that says her car was impounded, her Toyota RAV4 was impounded on the 3rd of November, but then they say that they found it on the 5th on the Avery Salvage Yard, and I think a lot of those reports are just moved from the 3rd up to the 5th, and they kind of just change over some names. So whatever happened to Teresa when she left Manitowoc, she left Lautenschlager's own backyard to begin with, and that would be the people that would have the information on what time she was going to be in Manitowoc. And it's just really discerning because Lautenschlager has kept quiet about this for 12 years, and Teresa is visiting the blood relative of her own campaign manager.
Incredible. We're going to use this gentleman as an opportunity to talk just for a second about our sponsor for this program, Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States, and as a result, seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals. Produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. Now, this week's menu includes, upcoming menus include, and I got a chance to try both of these, cheesy chicken and black bean enchiladas with salsa verde. And the second one, spiced cauliflower and pepper with jasmine rice and cilantro yogurt sauce. This was delicious. And it was made by me, gourmet cooking made by me at home. It's affordable for less than $10 per person per meal. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make your own delicious home-cooked meals. There's a variety, so you choose from a variety of new recipes each week, or you can let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. It's flexible, so you can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Blue Apron has several delivery options, so you can choose what fits your needs, and there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Each meal comes with a easy, believe me, step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and can be paired in, now, 30 minutes or less. Now, check out this week's menu and get $30 off. $30 off your first free meal by going to Blue Apron, and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/murder. That's blueapron.com/murder. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. When we last left off, we were talking about Teresa Halbach, and I wanted to ask you, how does this fit in, and what do you think about, we mentioned it last time, but this is something I'm stuck on, is the importance of the recorded messages on Teresa's answering machine and her brother's involvement and the court case, that when there's an opportunity to question something so important as the destruction of evidence. Tell us a little bit about Teresa Halbach's brother, how much he should have known about this, and how inappropriate is this?
Well, let's talk about both of Teresa Halbach's brothers. What's interesting is Mike Halbach, he was secured a job with the Green Bay Packers. He was first a video assistant. He was an intern, and then he became payroll help. There's the video director who was working with the Green Bay Packers since the 1970s, Ekberg, he has just officially retired, and Mike's been moving up the department over the last 12 years that of Teresa's alleged death and everything. So there's an interesting backstory on how Halbach was secured this job, and that goes with the person who took over Ekberg's employment is a University of Wisconsin law. He's a professor there, and he knows Lautenschlager really good, and Ekberg knows Lautenschlager really well. And when it comes down to my research, I kind of tie Halbach securing a dream job of having the Packers accredited to Lautenschlager securing that job to him. And let's talk about Tim Halbach, Teresa's older brother. 1 month before Teresa is dead, and she allegedly was killed October of 2005. Well, if you back up to September of 2005, her brother became the vice president of the Chilton Bar Association, and he went in partnership with this law firm, the Tuhig Law Firm, and George W. Tuhig is a lifelong resident and friend, again, of Miss Lautenschlager, and Tuhig's specialization was in dairy farms and the handling of land deeds and transactions after death. You had all this dairy farm stuff, and he was like the go-to guy in dairy farms. He graduated in 1973. Tim Halbach was a recent graduate, and you're pairing Halbach with Tuhig, and he's a lifelong friend of Lautenschlager and from the Fond du Lac area. He actually operates a funeral home within 10 miles of Lautenschlager's residential area. Mm-hmm. So for them to be partnered a month before her death, with my research, Tuhig was made the president of the Chilton Bar. The seed money to open this firm was, again, helped out with by the Attorney General Lautenschlager. And what this gives them as the Chilton Bar vice president and president of this association, plus they're opening this firm, they have all the legalities available at their law firm to wash any medical records of Teresa's parents, any medical records of Teresa. If you look at her death certificate, it is the most shadiest death certificate in the United States history. And they would be able to have privileged access to this. And I feel that Lautenschlager had paired these two up, because they knew they were going to have to wash something in her disappearance and her death, alleged death. So going on the Halbach brothers and where they stand, they got dream jobs. I mean, they're making high end dollars right now. And as far as her parents, Lautenschlager helped them out with a milk grant, MILC. It's a dairy farm association grant, where they benefit so much annually from proceeds from this grant. And it's like the Lautenschlagers or Lautenschlager had helped the Halbachs achieve all of this financial gain before Teresa's death. And that's something that concerns me, is that Tuhig and Halbach are right there in the mix of it. And that's one of Lautenschlager's lifelong friends.
And if you look at every single, you know, in the military, like a lot of times you advance because you're in combat or you're in the right place at the right time, et cetera. Every single person involved in this, whether it was Glenn Kaczynski, now with his, judgeship, whether it was the older brother, got into Two Hig Law Firm and I believe made partner at 26 years old. And Mike Halbach, I just recently saw a tweet where he basically had said, 12 years ago, I turned a family tragedy into something good, which, of course, you might look at and say, oh, okay, you know, with his sister's death, he got out in front of the cameras and, you know, that got him some publicity, et cetera, et cetera. But the way it's phrased, it kind of makes you think, okay, now he's one of the head video guys in the Green Bay Packers, which, of course, anything with the Packers in Wisconsin is anybody's dream job. But if you read that, it almost, you know, is like, oh, well, you know, my sister's death was wink, wink, nudge, nudge. What kind of got me into, you know, this green? Every single member, he'd mentioned Fassbender and Wiegert. They got awards for all this. Everybody got promotions. Everybody got this. And with that milk grant, I mean, if you really dig into it, it's almost as if, and I'm perfectly familiar with how this works, quote unquote political payoffs. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, you whatever donate to this, and I'll make sure that that plant gets built in your district, et cetera. So this is the exact kind of political wheeling and dealing and corruption. And if it is with Teresa Halbach's family, well, now that asks the other question. Okay. Well, if they're involved, how, why, you know, what happened? This is your own sister. How far does this go? Which direction does this go? So it opens up an entire new can of worms on that aspect alone, tying once again circularly back into all this and back into this circular seat of political corruption.
Is there something to the argument that this is a small place? We're not talking about a super densely populated area, the entire area that we are talking about. And if we are talking about that, if we're going to keep with a logical, if we're going to speculate, we're going to speculate somewhat, then what exactly was wrong with Teresa Halbach that the family could allow this to happen? So as you allude to about an illness, but again, what would that illness be, and where is any kind of evidence that other than a speculation, a speculative nature?
Well, Dan, the facts surrounding that, she has genetic illnesses in her family on her mother and father's side of both cystic fibrosis and mitochondrial myopia, which stem from both her parents. Richard Halbach died from complications of an injury in Brevard County and down in Florida near Cocoa Beach. I think everybody in my research that's directed me is that his wishes was when he died, Teresa's brother or Teresa's uncle married her mother. That was Richard Halbach, the biological father's brother, married Teresa's mother. And one of the reasons for this, the Halbachs stem from 200 years when they planted their German family. They come to Wisconsin 200 years ago, and it's to my knowledge of research into the dairy farm, the way it's handled, is that the youngest daughters and not the oldest sons are really the ones who get the financial gain in the family. So if Teresa's gone and Teresa's her uncle marries her mom and they have children, then the two daughters who were conceived by the uncle now and the mother, they're now in primary gain of the dairy farm estate. So there's a lot of things happening with the way that it's put down to the youngest instead of the oldest. And I think that's specifically designed because if you have genetic illnesses, a lot of people ain't going to live to old age. But if you pass it down to the youngest daughter, if you have a young daughter in the Hallback clan, which you do, then they get the trust left over from the dairy farm. And I mean, there was a trust put in Teresa Hallback's name and Tim Hallback's name prior to her death, like 1 month, and that would have been help established by George W. Tuhig when Tim and Tuhig opened the law firm. So as far as the evidence that she had illnesses, Kathleen Zellner actually has found a routine pharmacist that she was going to. Deputy O'Neill, who questioned Brendan Dassey and Cribbets just on November 6th, the day after the RAV4 was found, told Brendan Dassey, a lot of people don't know this, but Teresa has medicine that she needs to keep on a daily basis that she needs to take. And it later come out that Sheriff Jerry Pagel of Calumet County was saying that she was perfectly fine, this yada, yada, yada. But then take into consideration the own funeral of Teresa Hallback. When they give the family back the cremains, they hold a fundraiser for cystic fibrosis. And this is where a lot of her blue ribbon stuff comes from. But I mean, there's evidence that shows that that she could have possibly been terminally ill. And I do think that this information has been washed and covered up by the Hallback and Tuhig law firm.
If you go back to the interview that Brendan did with that officer when they were up north in the cabin, you can hear him say plain as day, you know, we need to help her out, Brendan. She's sick. She needs her medicine. We need to get her medicine. Now, some might say, oh, that's just cops trying to play tricks. But if you've got all this other clues to tie in, you know, you tell me. So just wanted to add that part to it.
Certainly. Now, you talk about what's next for Stephen Avery, and you talked about defense attorney Zellner. How soon can anything new and anything better happen for Stephen Avery after this decision? How long will it be likely?
Well, Dan, Zellner has made comments that she would try to get a new brief filed before Thanksgiving. And then when it's filed, I mean, you know, the courts, depending on which court it is, some of them can take to 3 years to go to court if they're ever going to be retried. So the actual determination of when he can be retried, there's no actual given date at this time. I mean, they could deny it. My guess is if we don't do something to get Norman Gann recused, Thomas J. Fallon recused, Brad Schimmel recused from being part of this, is that none of them, Dassey nor Avery, will ever get other trials. And again, it's because they don't want this opened up. And there's enough evidence that, I mean, I can show solid evidence that his own defense counsel was in Lautenschlager's pocket. And that's some information I wanted to get out tonight also. But as far as a court date, there might not ever be a court date unless we drive this home. I mean, people need to divert their eyes from Ken Kratz, start looking up to Thomas J. Fallon, because he was Peg Lautenschlager's right-hand man during this. He come from Peg Lautenschlager's office. He was her little minion, so I can call him, and he come in and he took over. And when you have that much power in a courthouse, I mean, you're pretty much twisting arms. And I want to touch base on a case that happened January of 2007, right before February 2007, when Stephen Avery's case started. Thomas J. Fallon protected these two attorneys that had raped a female in Chicagoland, and then the outcome of this case, these two Wisconsin state attorneys were given lighter sentences, no prison time, but they were involved in a sexual assault and rape of a female victim. The prosecutor that was the star prosecutor that worked with Fallon, he was criticized in the media for giving these Wisconsin attorneys leniency. So he resigned his position, saying he was taking his dream job in Tennessee, and he just left. He just threw away his prosecution career and left, and that was because he was under scrutiny by the media. But it goes to show you that this is only 1 month before Fallon does Stephen Avery's trial, but he's in cooperation with attorneys and the prosecutor of this case. So it goes to show you what he's doing in Stephen Avery's trial. Dean Strang is Tom Fallon's best friend. They're colleagues. So Fallon mentions in Making a Murderer, if they want to say Manitowoc County framed him because all this stuff, then they do so at their own peril. Well, the thing about that, Strang's office was right across from Fallon and Lautenschlager's, literally across the street. And so, in the O.J. Simpson case, it was 8 months trial. There were less than 25 judges' chambers meeting off records. In this trial of Stephen Avery, in just a little over 2 months, there was 120 off-record judges' chambers meetings with Fallon, Kratz, Gann, Buting, and Dean Strang. And these were off record. I mean, 120 times, over 120 times.
Wow.
This was off record. And if you're in that position behind closed doors with Fallon, who just 1 month worked with attorneys and the prosecutor and gave leniency to attorneys and didn't charge them to the max for sexually assaulting and raping a female. That just shows that he's working right alongside with attorneys and prosecutors, and it questions Fallon's ethical role in anything to do with Stephen Avery's trial, especially whenever he is Peg Lautenschlager's right-hand man. And he was also deposed in Stephen Avery's civil suit. Michael Griesbach was deposed. Mark Roer was deposed. They were not allowed to participate as a prosecutor in the murder trial. Neither should Fallon have been able to participate.
And so, you were – oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say you asked a little while ago about, like, how small things are. Well – I don't know what state you're residing in currently, but 40 out of the 50 states, basically, you can't walk into a tavern or a restaurant and smoke a cigarette. Now, that decision was made by probably a couple hundred legislators and the governor, right, told however many millions of people that regardless of what you or the owner or whatever anybody else wanted, you're going to do this. And the actual people that wrote that bill, you're probably talking in the dozens, maybe, okay? So when Chad's talking about, you know, Strang and Fallon being across the street from each other, and you talk about the court system, Dean Strang is part of a law firm of Strang, Bradley, and Bradley. Now, the two Bradleys are a male and a female that just happen to be the son and the daughter of Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. So when you talk about a state of 5.7 million people and whatever Chad mentioned, 20, 25,000 attorneys, yet somehow all these people kind of run in the exact same circles and reside together. So and that also, if it does go past this next appellate court and goes to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, because Dean Strang was the one that was on the original trial, and yet Sutkowitz or Angela, whatever her name is, she mentioned all the stuff that you can't use from the past. Well, is that going to be grounds that Ann Walsh Bradley is going to recuse herself because the original attorney that defended Stephen Avery is part of the law firm of Strang, Bradley, and Bradley, both of those her kids? Or is she going to rule on this case, you know, against Stephen Avery? So when we're talking about all this circular, everything ties into another, it just keeps going and going. It's like the Energizer Bunny. And honestly, we're just scratching the surface here. You know, this book is 270-some pages, and you've read it. But for anyone out there listening, I implore you to read this book because it is just going to blow your mind. And the fact that nobody's looked into this before, nobody's talked about this before, then this is probably the most important part because, again, evidence, schmevidence, if you've got somehow people working together to stack a deck for whatever the motive, for whatever the reason, and we manage to bring this to light, you get some petition signed. That's force that can make, you know, the higher powers, the higher courts, the people not involved in this that can take a look at this. Like, for example, the new U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin that hopefully is going to get cleared by the Senate sometime soon. Hopefully he's a good man. He can look into it with all this, which means it doesn't matter what Dassey's attorney does or what judges do to him. It doesn't matter what Zellner finds. If he goes in there and brings it to court for these people, for this evidence that we've found, then Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey have a real chance instead of having to go through the rigmarole of the corrupt Wisconsin Fox Valley court system. That's why this book is so important.
Right. Why do you think someone that was instrumental in having Stephen Avery released in the first place from the wrongful conviction, Michael Griesbach from the Innocence Project, I interviewed him, and he said that Stephen Avery is guilty. And then I asked, does he not deserve another trial? And everything that I've looked at, and not being as professionally qualified to make that conclusion, I still think, in light of everything I've looked at, that he deserves another trial. What do you make of Michael Griesbach, his position in this, his role in this, and yet he thinks that he does not deserve another trial? What do you make of that?
Well, Dan, if you want to get into Michael Griesbach, when Stephen was exonerated, he was the one who approached Lautenschlager and said, hey, we got some miscarriages of justice going on in my office. Dennis Vogel and Tom Kasurek just sent found out that Stephen had been sent off for 18 years in prison. Now, Michael Griesbach at this point, during this time, I believe he was doing what was right to prompt an investigation, but there's something that Michael Griesbach failed to tell you during an interview, and that's, I don't know if you discussed how his brother was handling Avery's civil suit. Federal Magistrate Judge William Griesbach, he was actually handling Stephen Avery's civil suit. That's why he had to recuse himself, because Michael was deposed. Now, William Griesbach announced his resignation and recused himself on September 26th, but there were some big things happening in Madison at the state capitol during this time, and that was with Lautenschlager distributing these pamphlets that discerned tunnel vision, jailhouse snitches, electronic monitoring of juveniles, contaminated evidence, and all these things were going out in these pamphlets. Now you have to take into consideration, Lautenschlager took over the Avery Task Force on August 30th, so you have 26 days later, William Griesbach is recusing himself. And this is only days after Peg Lautenschlager distributes these pamphlets. Now, this commission that Peg had restarted when she took over the Avery Task Force and redesigned it to her own liking and her own doing, these people involved, again, were prosecutors, judges, crime lab people, attorneys, etc. And William Griesbach, being a federal magistrate judge, would be privy to the political information going on. He's at a high-tier level to know what's happening in the attorney general's office and with this political agenda. So when he resigns, he wants to make it apparent that he done it because Michael Griesbach was deposed, but it's really because he didn't want no part of Lautenschlager's political agenda that was going on, and he tells Griesbach to stay away from the case, and Griesbach never touched it. Michael Griesbach never touched it after this, and I think those two brothers were protecting each other, but where Michael Griesbach has, I've lost all, you know, I don't have no respect for him anymore. He didn't ever blow the whistle on what was happening with the pamphlets that were distributed by Lautenschlager that could have protected not only Stephen Avery, but Brendan Dassey. You know, and this was their political agenda to not have people wrongfully convicted. But here you got a federal magistrate stepping down because he would be in a position to know everything that's going on with this commission controlled by Lautenschlager. And for that, for Michael Griesbach to just play like he doesn't know what's going on there, he wasn't allowed to prosecute. He stayed away from the case. That's because his brother is telling him, hey, you need to get away. You need to dissociate yourself with this. And Michael Griesbach, you know, if he knew what his brother knew and they've talked about it, then, yeah, he would have no choice right now but to say that Stephen Avery's guilty, because that's protecting him and his brother. So there's some questions there. And I ask Michael Griesbach these questions in my book, you know, that he needs to step up and answer for this. He needs to stand accounted for this dissociation of the murder trial from Hallback.
Well, and this might be a good segue, and I forgive me, Dan, if you got other things, but this might be a good segue for what you talked about for Brendan, because, you know, this kind of thing, and you'd mentioned it during the intro, that how Brendan was, you know, could have been let go the very month if they hadn't have done what they'd done. So I just want to make sure we hit that, you know, before the end of the program. So I don't know if that's something you may want to discuss now or since we head on it, but.
Sure, certainly.
So
let's
lay
more
it on
about
it, Chad.
Okay, what exactly, Juan, are you referring to at the moment? Like, just.
Well, how Brendan, because of the rules that they put in place, you know, on February 23rd,
right,
days before, and we don't have to do it now. I just want to make sure because that's an incredibly important part that nobody knows about yet. So I didn't want to step on Dan's toes, but again, I want to make sure we discuss that because that's huge.
Right. And before we get into that, Dan, there's a little backstory here that making a murderer supporters and viewers and watchers around the globe, we're talking millions and millions of people that aren't aware of. Okay. My book exposes the timeline of Jerry Buting's involvement with he was a golden ticket. I mean, Juan can vouch for me for this. There were 20 members seated to the Avery Task Force, and they were seated in a bipartisan effort by the state capitol. And when you became a member on this, I mean, that gave you privileged access to whatever was happening politically with Stephen Avery's exoneration. It gave you privileged access to the Attorney General and the high-end people working in the Department of Justice in the state capitol. And Buting was one of these people. Now, my largest concern that I want to drive home about Jerome Buting is that he had the golden ticket. He was one of 20 people seated and was colleagues like Norman Gann, who introduced this blood theory, was Jerome Buting's colleague for 2 years. And then for them to come back on a murder trial and prosecute and defend Stephen Avery while they're sitting on a commission with Peg Lautenschlager is the most severe conflict of interest. You have Griesbach who recused himself. You have a federal judge that recused himself. You have a lot of Mark Roer that wasn't allowed to participate. in this prosecution because they had dealings with the exoneration or were attached to the political agenda of the exoneration of Stephen Avery. And we're talking the exoneration of Stephen's 1985 charge in 2003 when he's exonerated. So if you're working that in politically or the legalities of it, you shouldn't be touching this murder charge, especially when you're on a commission with Peg Lautenschlager. And this is one of the biggest misconceptions of making a murderer, and I'm going to throw it out right here and right now. This has been one of mine and Juan's hardest hurdles to overcome, and people were brainwashed into how much of a hero Dean Strang and Jerome Budin are shown to be on making a murderer. But, I mean, Ken Kratz says on a radio show when he introduced his book that Budin helped even film and direct Making a Murderer. And this is concerning because the only reason the state of Wisconsin allowed this trial to even be filmed, and I got the document, it's a fact. I mean, this isn't no BS, it's not no bullshit, this is a fact. Thomas J. Fallon wrote a letter to Judge Patrick Willis, who presided in Stephen Avery's case, and said, hey, we need to video the defense team of Stephen Avery, record them, so Stephen Avery can never claim ineffective counsel. And that is the only reason that the creators were allowed to even film this trial, because the state asked for it. And again, you go back to Dean Strang being best friends with Thomas J. Fallon, and you go back to Budin in the pocket of Lautenschlager. And it's just so disturbing of how this is misconceived by all these people. They don't realize Jerome Budin is politically attached to this case. And all they see is just that he's a hero. But when you do the research, and I laid the timeline out, it's not just like a day or 2 days. He's attached to Lautenschlager for 4 years. He's on Lautenschlager's commission when Stephen Avery has hired Budin and Strang to defend him. It just blows my mind that nobody can see the severe conflict of interest. And I mean, it was a bipartisan effort, you know, of all this task force, but Juan's right there in the heart of the politics in Wisconsin, and Juan, maybe you can confirm that, you know, that these people shouldn't have been working the murder trial if they were involved in the exoneration politically or any other way, period.
And that's correct. And you know, when it comes to judges, when it comes to attorneys, you know, everyone says, well, they're supposed to be, you know, nonpartisan and non-biased and all this stuff. But everybody knows it's human. And if it weren't for all these little idiosyncrasies and all these things tying in, I might actually buy that argument. Okay, well, maybe it's just – but, you know, one is existence, two is coincidence, three is pattern. How many threes, fours, five, six, seven, 18, 19, 99, 102? How many connections do you need before there's finally a pattern to where you say, okay, something else is going on here? Now, we're not saying exactly what, but you can have a pretty good idea. And again, what's the motive behind that? You know, you've got people that are recusing themselves, but other people that should have recused themselves that didn't. Yet when you've got instances, I mean, just the simple stuff, you know, Jerry Budin is supposed to be this forensic expert and he doesn't cross-examine, you know, it doesn't get the bullet thrown out. You've got, I can't remember if it was Fallon or Gunn that said, well, we have to make the evidence, you know, fit to, in order for it to make sense. You know, I mean, these things, they should have been absolutely thrown out of court. And there's an instance when Colborn's on the stand and he said, well, I got called away because somebody, you know, some group of people found some evidence at the Mirabeau Caves Park. They never said, oh, well, what evidence? What did they find? Go look at the transcript. It's like, okay, well, I got pulled away. Of course, it's always Colborn. Pulled away to say evidence. What evidence? You never mentioned it. You never asked. It's like, you know, these simple things that these quote-unquote top attorneys should have done, they didn't do. And then you find out all about this. Then you find out how they tie in. And again, you know, Chad, yeah, when people hear this story about the child videotape surveillance and what they could have done to Brendan and didn't, it's going to blow your mind. He was telling me about it, and it blew my mind. I was like, how did anybody not know about this? But then again, how did anybody not know about all this stuff? So, I mean, Chad, if you want to tell that again, I don't know what time we got remaining, but that story that needs to be told. So, I don't know if you got any other questions, Dan, but like I said, that one's gonna blow people away.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay. Now this is part of the timeline of. It kind of puts into perspective that when Stephen Avery hires Jerome Buting and Dean Strang as their defense counsel, it connects Buting to Lautenschlager still on this commission whenever Dassey actually is allegedly coerced in his confession. If you go to the charter statement of the Wisconsin Criminal Justice Study Commission, and this is what replaced the Avery Task Force, Buting gets on Making a Murder and says, yeah, I was part of the Avery Task Force, but what Buting purposely leaves out is that he and Peg Lautenschlager changed it into something else, and it was still happening at the time of Stephen Avery's pretrial in the time of Brendan's coercion and when Stephen was in jail. Now the charter statement says the goal of our commission will not be to point fingers or assign blame for past mistakes as some might understandably fear. And while the wrongful conviction of Stephen Avery and others are a major stimulus for this commission, the commission's role will not to be identify specific cases of wrongful conviction. Okay, so what that's doing in their charter statement, they're saying that Manitowoc County, we're not going to state they had anything to do with Stevens, with the wrongful conviction. And Lautenschlager, like her December 17th, 2003 report was to protect Manitowoc. And now you have Buting coming on board. Buting was seated in the beginning by Mark Gundrum in 2003 to save money for the state. And when he settles out, what you have Buting doing is preventing Stephen Avery from going forward with this federal civil suit. So Buting's job is accomplished. Now what people don't realize is that Buting will sit there and lie. He lies in his book. He lies in Super Loggers magazine. He says that Dean Strang got him involved in this case, when really, if you go back to Making a Murderer on episode 3, starting at 19 minutes, Stephen Avery places a phone call to Stephen Glenn, who is his civil suit attorney. And Stephen Glenn tells him, I have two attorneys that I have in mind for you. If you settle out, you can get this money and you can proceed with this criminal case. But Glenn doesn't never tell Stephen Avery that he's sitting on the commission with Peg Lautenschlager. So Strang, who isn't even involved in this at the time, why does it take Dean Strang to get Jerome Buting involved when Glenn and Buting are meeting from August, September, October, November, December, January, February, and March, all the way up until Brendan's confession? They're meeting every month and meeting in person. Why does it Glenn just ask Buting in person? And this is what he did, but Buting will lie and say that Dean Strang brought him involved. Got him involved on the case, but that's not the way it worked. So there's a big discernment for Brendan's confession. It's on March 1st, but if you back up to February 23rd, Jerome Buting was the person who drafted and crafted the model policy for Peg Lautenschlager's juvenile monitoring of electronic juvenile against juveniles. So with her doing this and Budin doing it for her, they could have protected Brendan Dassey, but both of them failed to do it.
So, I mean, the main point we want to stress here, because obviously, you know, we're just two guys, right? We're trying to get this information out there, but one of our biggest hurdles has been the fact that Jerome Budin is this hero. Well, you just heard him say, and, you know, you can go right to the tape, you can go right to the episode and see it. So I'll give you an example. If there's a dead guy in a room, just died of a single gunshot wound, cop busts in and there's a gun between Chad and I say, I shot him. Chad says, no, I shot him. Okay, there's a chance, logically, that neither of us shot him. But regardless, one of us is lying. All right, so hopefully everyone followed that. Now, if you take, and there's more information in the book, okay? If Jerome Budin is tied with Peg Lautenschlager is tied with Fallon, Fallon is tied with Ken Kratz is tied in with, you know, the Manitowoc and Calumet police and law enforcement departments. So now you've got Jerome Budin, who is in bed with all these people, this hero, right? All right, but he says that it was Dean Strang right before all this happened, right before they could have saved Brendan from that recording and from being persecuted, yet they didn't. So you've got Dean Strang and Jerry Budin in this, where he says that Strang was the one that called him. Yet Stephen Glenn, who was Stephen Avery's civil suit attorney, who's the one who got him out, okay, got him out and got him exonerated on that first one. And you see him right in the beginning of Making a Murderer. He says, well, you would have thought that Stephen Avery was the worst criminal in the world after all the appeals that he lost. And if it weren't for the fact that a couple of new evidence came forward and DNA testing, he probably still would have. Actually, I think he would have just gotten out last year on his original case. But now you've got Stephen Glenn, okay, who's also on all these committees, okay, miraculously. Again, small world, even though there's 5.7 million people in Wisconsin. Stephen Glenn, who's helping Stephen Avery get out the first time, calls up Jerome Budin, who's tied in with all these people, and yet Jerome Budin says it was Dean Strang. Again, just like the cop with the bullet, logic could dictate that regardless of whether or not something was done, one of them is lying. So you have to decide which one that is. Who's telling the truth and why, or who's lying and why? Because if Stephen Glenn, all right, is calling Jerome Budin before any of this starts and Budin ties in, that forms the circle that I've been talking about this whole time. And if that's the case, and that's the stackers of the deck, do you realize what we're looking at here? And then again, it goes to what are they hiding? What did that investigation stop? I'm kind of getting chills thinking about it, because if what we're saying, all right, does coincide, and I'll be the first to admit, you know what? Every single one of these hundreds of things could be just a coincidence. Okay. But I have eyes, you have eyes, you realize that if you're old enough and been around this world long enough that, you know, that even there's a phrase in law enforcement, there's no such thing as a coincidence. What are we dealing with? What are they hiding? Why did this judge all of a sudden, again, slam this down? And this is the stuff that we need as a nation, as a world, to get behind this and to find out the truth, because the only thing that's going to make this happen is one of three things: that they actually go through the court systems and somehow reign victorious, that you have an outside force like a U.S. attorney or the attorney general actually look into this and trump these people and what they can do and what they can hide, or we get enough people around the world and enough public pressure to say, no, this needs to be investigated, this needs to be done, because that is the thing that it, throughout mankind, has moved mountains, and that is what this book is about, and that's what needs to be done. So that I can't stress that enough, that people need to read this, they need to understand this, and they need to know that even if you think Jerome Budin is a hero, at least look at this with an open mind. At least look at all the connections first and then make your decisions. Because and everyone thinks, you know, when anything in the world, you know, there's a phrase that says, graveyards are full of people that said it can never happen to me. Well, guess what? It happened to Stephen Avery. It's happened to people that I know personally, which is how I got involved in this. So, you know, that's what we need to bring to light. So I'm sorry for taking up so much time, but again, that's the essence of this whole thing, and that's why we're fighting so hard, is because this could happen to anybody, and these men need to be freed, and we don't know what's going to go through the judicial system, so we need to be, as American citizens and just human beings, to get this out there and to make this right.
I want to ask this question because we have very little time. I want to ask about the possibility of the Making a Murderer fan base, because the Making of a Murderer fan base, just one little tidbit of information, a person like Alec Baldwin, I don't know how influential he is, but we've seen what celebrities can do, their money and their support and their fan base can help as well in the court of public opinion. How likely is Making a Murderer going to discern what you're saying and jump on your ship? Or is the Making a Murderer fan base demanding another trial could be effective? Tell me what you think about this prospect.
As far as having anybody to back us up in the media or anything, what really needs to happen is, before any trial ever goes forward, these questions need to be answered before going forward. I mean, Jerome Butin could have literally walked across the street from Dean Strang's office in March. He was there on March 1st, the same day that Brendan Dassey was interrogated. That same month, he could have walked directly over to Lautenschlager's office and said, "Hey, you know that model policy for the juveniles I just drafted for you on the 23rd, like literally 7 days ago? We need it to protect this kid." But Lautenschlager was nowhere to be found, yet she's signing off on the evidence of the bullet in the garage, and Jerry Butin has never blown the whistle on Lautenschlager to this day, when we know all the Making Murderer fans know that Lautenschlager is a force to be reckoned with, but Jerry will deny his affiliation with it. But that's where my book comes in. Facts, you cannot change facts. And the facts are, they had an affiliation for 4 years. It wasn't just, oh, he's going to hang out with her because he's an attorney and they do this. No, he had the golden ticket designated by Mark Gundrum to get there. So as far as whoever gets behind us, whether it's Making a Murderer fans, Alec Baldwin, anybody, I mean, just any celebrity, what really needs to happen, these questions need to be answered, that my book asks Lautenschlager, asks Greisbach, asks Kratz, asks Jerome Butin. I mean, Fallon needs recused more than anything in the world in this case right now. I mean, if we're going to proceed forward, we're laying the facts out. We need somebody to stand behind us and just have a voice, make an impact, or they'll never come home. And I believe that Stephen's innocent. I believe Brendan Dassey's innocent. I wouldn't invest in anything into this if I didn't believe in their innocence. I mean, if you look at the facts and the timeline, it's a political conviction, and it needs to be exposed immediately.
Well, the thing I'll say on that. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. I wanted to say on that, me knowing politics like it is, actually was watching comedian Doug Stanhope talk about this past election, and he said, "I voted for Gary Johnson because he follows my Twitter." And that's the problem with democracy. And there's another scene in the movie Tommy Boy where Dan Aykroyd signed the contract simply because live TV is there and he's thinking everybody's watching it. And then it goes to that diner and says, "Hey, you guys want to watch this American Gladiators?" And they say, "Oh, let's watch American Gladiators." Now, when Making a Murderer came out, it was a huge fervor. But just like anything, and I think I said this in my first or second video that I made, that, you know, it's eventually going to die down because it doesn't, because the court proceedings are so much and, you know, they've taken so many hits. But hopefully with this new evidence that we found, this will generate an even bigger force. But, you know, and again, you know, we're just two guys. You know, we're trying as hard as we can to get some sort of, you know, national platform because, again, unless we've got the backing of the people, but you can't like or dislike that which you do not know. We need to get this out there. You need to spread the word. You know, hey, Christmas is coming up. You got, you know, Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Buy this book and give it to your relatives if you're at all interested in making a murder. If you've ever had somebody, you know, get screwed over by the court system, hey, this is something for them. You know, and again, this is something to where, you know, everybody needs to be concerned because that it will never happen to me. When it all of a sudden happens to you, it really hits home. And just like we were saying earlier, when you're behind bars, you have to wait. It's not like, oh, I'm going to sit there and wait for 3 years and get to watch football and American Gladiator. No, you're sitting in a prison cell while the courts churn. And Chad knows this very well, and I've had my own personal experiences with that. But we need to have that same fervor that we had before. And I truly believe that if people find out about this, this is going to make Watergate look like a Harper Valley PTA meeting. So if we can get celebrities, great. If we can get national exposure, great. But whatever happens, we're going to need the public's backing because the one thing I'll tell you about politicians, just like with that American Gladiator, you get a politician on an issue that 20 people call in and say, I want you to vote this way, they will vote that way, even though their district has 170,000 people. That will get their attention. It will make them change, even though I guarantee you the people, you know, in the attorney general's office and the courts, they won't. But that doesn't mean we can't get people in power that are above them to make that change and to make this happen.
I want to thank you, gentlemen. Our time is up. We were talking about Stephen Avery, Retrial Denied, and your book about Stephen Avery and the Beyond Avery Road. So I want to thank you, Chad Spencer Keller and Juan Tesgrue. That's an alias, a pseudonym. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for coming on for this compelling program. And just briefly, Chad, can you tell us a little bit about the Facebook page or how they might contact you or look at this information? Tell us about the websites, Facebook pages. Tell us about that.
Anybody interested, they can go to www.productionsouth.com, and I'll comment a link on the blog site where they can purchase the book, everything. So it'll be up on this interview in the comments.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Chad Keller and Juan Tesgrue, for an incredible evening, incredible interview. Thank you very much. You have a great night. Hope to talk to you gentlemen again soon. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Dan.
Good night.